Welcome to Girls on Pop, episode 17. I'm your co-host, Maureen Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host,
Ashley Lynch.
We're back to talk about some stuff.
We are back, baby.
So you actually shared a couple of articles that are pretty interesting. I don't think that they're going to come as much of a surprise, but there's some interesting stuff to talk about there. And that was a recent, we're jumping right in, a recent UCLA article about diverse casts and how movies with diverse casts actually make better bang at the box office. Is this a surprise to anybody?
Yeah, no, it's definitely not a surprise to me. And it's something I've been saying for a long time. But yeah, it's nice to see some actual data on it now where they basically went through and they covered a bunch of years and showed how basically there has been an increase in diverse audiences with diverse film, with more diverse leading films, you know, more representation from the camera. And it's gotten to a point where even Disney has started to turn away projects that are perfectly good projects, but don't have the type of diversity that they're looking for in their films now, because this is what is going to give them the greatest amount of success. And we've been seeing this for a while. I mean, the other thing that I pulled up is that Fast and Furious 7 came out. It was found that 75% of the audience was non-white. And specifically with that movie, it is a ethnically diverse cast. It's like most of the people in that movie, not white. And the result is you get a lot more of a diverse audience that comes out because they're seeing themselves represented on screen. And all of a sudden the box office goes up. And the conventional thinking has always been that women will come out for guys' movies, but guys won't do the same. People of color will come out for white leading movies, but white people won't do the same. And so the default becomes the white male lead and have everyone else just sort of like, well, we'll fall in because there's really nothing else. And so that was always the conventional thinking, but that is now reversing to the point where this, people are seeing the very obvious fact that the more of a diverse audience that you draw and attract in, the more you not only cover whatever like downside you might have from the white male audience that chooses not to participate, but it even surpasses that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's been, you mentioned the Fast and Furious franchise, and that's certainly the most obvious because it's become such a successful behemoth of a franchise. But I mean, I think that's been true for a long time. You know, as soon as you start seeing casts that look like you, there's a better chance that you're going to attract a larger audience. It's just the reality of it is. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, that audience, that white audience is starting to, especially the baby boomers. I mean, at some point they're going to die off. you need to talk to the demographic that's going to be buying those movie tickets. And that demographic is largely non-white. So, I mean, they're really doing the work. I hesitate, with, stories like the Disney, pushing back against like not taking on projects that aren't as diverse as they would like, because I think that's still, there's still a lot of work to be done. I think it's a good step forward, but the reality of it is as well that they also have a lot of people of color already working within the studio that aren't getting the opportunity to create the projects that they want to create. I think it's a good step in the right direction, but it's still not anywhere near where it needs to be. And the studios really do need to do more. And they need to look, they don't even need to look outside to find that talent. That talent is already there. They just need to give that talent an opportunity. You see it all the time. Absolutely. Women getting passed over, people of color getting passed over. Like, those are the people that you need to be leaning on because you already have that talent in your pool. You just need to give them a chance.
Absolutely. 100% agree. It is getting better. slowly, but it is getting better. So that's always a good sign. And I think these attitudes are definitely a good sign. One thing that I always say, though, is that it is not even so much, we see the representation in front of the camera. And that's something that's very obvious to kind of pinpoint. But where I think the biggest difference, the biggest systemic change that we're going to see inside the industry is not going to come from people in front of the camera. It's going to come from the people behind the camera. It's going to be the people who are telling their stories. Like, you know, it only goes so far if you're like, oh, here's a heartwarming story about Black women overcoming their trials and tribulations in a racist society as told by a white man. You know, so it's, you do see this constantly, and it's important that the people behind the camera are reflecting who we want to be telling these stories. And that's when we're going to start to get really diverse points of view that are coming across. And we are seeing that more and more.
One of the things that really surprised, not surprised me, but one of the things that was really obvious about this past Oscar season is the fact that so much of the behind the scenes talent was people of color. And there were, mm-hmm. you look at across the board at so a lot of the winners, there were a lot of firsts during the Oscars, well, for a reason, because mm-hmm. there was a lot more diversity shown behind the camera as well. It reminded me of the year that Mad Max won a bunch of craft awards, and everybody that was going up is like, well, there goes another woman. There goes another woman. Mm-hmm. It's like, talking. But that was an amazing year too.
Yeah. Oh, and this year, like, we had Chloe Zhao win Best Director Award, the second woman ever to win Best Director Catherine Bigelow, first woman of color to win Best Director. But not only that, even more impressive than Chloe Zhao's win, which is impressive to me, is the fact that there were multiple women in the Best Director category. That never happens.
Right.
That is a new thing. Yeah. And I don't think enough people are talking about what a giant shift that is.
Yeah.
So that makes me very happy.
Me too. I was thrilled. I mean, I think what I'm hoping, and I hope that it's not just because, you know, last year just happened to be a really weird year as well. So I hope it's not like this weird
blip. It certainly helped.
Yeah, I hope it's not just this little blip, and I hope that it's actually like a marked change in how we're going to move forward going mm-hmm. forward. But I mean, I guess the next year, the rest of the year will tell. But it was certainly, I was really happy with the way things turned out, so I can't complain.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, just a, you know, sidebar, but the actual Oscar ceremony itself, having it be like, you know, COVID creating this alternate universe where, you know, a year where barely any movies got released, and they're doing this ceremony, and they end up doing like this really kind of small, like, dinner party like ceremony that I actually found refreshingly nice.
Me too.
Dug it.
Yeah, me too.
Compared to previous years. I hope they keep that up. I don't want to see the giant to-do anymore. I think just the small little gathering is fine.
Yeah, I thought it was a fine show. I mean, it was a bit dry in places, and you could clearly tell that there was an anticipation for the end of that show that ended not the way they expected it to. But I think overall, I mean, we watched it, we enjoyed it, and admittedly, yes, okay, so we didn't have the blockbusters in 2020 that, you know, we were expecting to see. But overall, it was a superb year for movies.
Yeah.
Like, everything that was nominated. And those
movies never get highlighted at the Oscars anyways.
So. No. I mean, it was a superb year for movies. All the categories were stacked. It was a really, really good year overall. And I mean, I think if you don't think that good movies came out last year, then you certainly didn't watch enough movies.
Yeah, absolutely. It's there's always people that complain. It's like, oh, could we make anything other than superhero movies for once, please? It's like, if you think the only thing that's coming out of superhero movies, it's because you're actively not looking. Yeah. You're trying to ignore everything else, because there are a lot of movies that come out every year that are not that.
Yeah.
And a lot of those films were highlighted there at the Oscars.
Yeah. And I mean, there were some like decent superhero movies last year.
Oh, right? For sure.
I think out loud, I'm like, what did I watch that I liked? I liked Bloodshot. I don't know.
Does that count? I think Birds of Prey was probably my favorite.
Oh, that was definitely that. I think that was the last thing I saw in a theater.
That was the last one I saw in the theater too.
Yeah, and it was a good one to end with. I really like that movie.
I'm very much looking forward to finally getting cooked so I can go back to the theater.
Right, right. Should we get into some of the stuff we've been watching? Because I think our list is quite long and there's some good stuff in the mix.
Yeah, we have a nice varied list, so I'm very excited about this.
Yeah, okay, kick us off.
Okay, so I'm going to, this was a late addition to my list, but I was very excited and happy to see this movie. Is a new movie, animated film, came out on Netflix called The Mitchells vs. the Machines, which is an animated film produced by Lord and Miller of Into the Spider-Verse and 21 Jump Street fame, and is directed by Mike Rionda and Jeff Rowe, who did Gravity Falls. So it has that same kind of sort of like stylistic approach that Gravity Falls has, and a little bit of like that kind of sense of humor and approach as well. But this movie blew me away. I mean, the short premise is basically dysfunctional family that's constantly fighting with themselves suddenly finds themselves in the middle of the robot apocalypse, where an AI has woken up and has decided man is a problem, so I'm just going to gather them all up and shoot them all into space. That's the entire premise. And so the Mitchells, this dysfunctional family, are the only humans that are left, and they have to basically stop the AI. And in typical, I don't know how much Lord Miller had a hand in the screenplay, but it feels like a lot, because in the same way that they embraced kind of not repackaging, but being self-aware of the culture and of the audience's awareness of culture and integrating that into the world and putting it back at people in a way which is both subversive and surprisingly entertaining, is very much their trademark. It's what they did in the Jump Street movies. It's what they did in the Lego movie. It's like, and that same sort of sense of humor is on display here. Yeah. And I can't remember, I don't think I've laughed so hard in a full year. I honestly don't. I had to stop the movie at points because I was cackling so hard. It's just so good. And also, a little bit of an aside, like the main character, the protagonist of this film, is a young redheaded queer girl who is going to film school and is socially awkward and gets in a fight with her parents about whether or not she can actually make a job in film, and she should really just have a backup plan for when her dreams don't pan out. And I'm like, get out of my life, movie. That's me. I had that exact conversation with my mother when I wanted to get into film. And it's just like, oh my God, it touched me on so many levels.
Oh, I didn't have that personal connection clearly, but I really, really like this movie. And like you, I haven't laughed this hard in a really long time. And I'm excited to watch it a second time, because I know for a fact that there are, like, after I picked up a couple of little tidbits that weren't like totally obvious, I'm like, there is probably more crammed into this movie that I missed on the first time that now I need to watch it again just to get all the references. And I laughed. I lost my shit at the Journey reference, to the point where I pretty much rolled off the couch. I was laughing so hard.
It was the Furbies that broke me.
Oh my God.
That was the breaking point for me.
So Dan was kind of dozing on and off on the couch as we were watching it. And I guess he woke up at some point. He's like, are those, is that a giant Furby? I'm like, yeah, you missed it. It's just so bad shit. It's so good.
Yeah.
So good.
So I cannot recommend this movie enough. Everyone needs to. It's like I said, it's on Netflix. Just drop what you're doing and watch it. I woke up this morning. It's like, you know, I want to watch it again.
Oh, yeah. It's so much fun. I'm really, really happy that this turned out like it did. We've been tracking it for a while. And I was a little disappointed when it didn't come out originally when it was supposed to come out. And then I was a bit worried that they were going to bury it all together. So I was really, really thrilled when it was announced that it was going to Netflix and that, you know, people were going to get a chance to see it. And thankfully, it's turned out as good as we expected. So,
this one is from Sony Animation, same people who did Into the Spider-Verse.
Yep.
Another amazing film. So far, Sony Animation has a really good track record.
Yep. They're killing it.
At least as long as Lord Miller associated with them.
Yeah.
And this was supposed to come out in theaters. And of course, because of the crazy year that we had, it did not. And they ended up selling it to Netflix, which is a bit of a disappointment because it would have been nice to see this come out in theaters. On the other hand, I'm not sure it would have been a super success when it came out. I think people would have looked at it and go, what is that? And maybe not have gone to see it.
Yeah.
So I think on Netflix, it's actually going to be incredibly successful. So
I agree. Yay.
Yeah.
Do you want me to give you?
Yeah. What's something on your list?
Okay. So the other thing that came out the same day as The Mitchells was The Stowaway on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. This is written and directed by Joe Pena and stars Anna Kendrick, Daniel Day Kim, and Toni Collette as a trio of astronauts that are on their way to Mars. And they get out of the Earth's atmosphere and they discover a stowaway on board. It's not the story that you might expect because it turns out not to be like this nefarious. Like, how do you account for everything? How do you not notice that you have extra weight on board of a full human? And how the hell did he get, like, nobody asks the question, how did he end up where he ended up as the stowaway? Like, he was literally behind a panel on the ceiling.
How do you just hang out in the rafters while you're breaking the atmosphere?
Right? Nobody asks this question. It's never explored how this guy ended up there. Like, clearly you don't just fall in there. There were screws keeping him in place. The whole thing is just, like, kind of crazy. Ultimately, it looks amazing. As far as a space movie goes, it looks really, really good. And they do some spacewalk things that are kind of fun. But as the movie itself, it's just kind of not. It's just not that good.
A little bit of a ridiculous fair.
Yeah, it misses. It has all these like giant blind spots, and you're like, ask these questions, and they never get asked. Mm-hmm. I do like some of the things in it. I mean, the fact that we never actually, it's the entire thing takes place on the spaceship and in space. They never like go back to Earth to Mission Control. You never hear anybody from Mission Control. Toni Collette plays the captain, and she's on with Mission Control all the time, but it's always through a headset, and you never fully hear what they're saying. You only see her side of the story. So there are some really interesting things at play. Just the movie just falls kind of flat, and the ending is really kind of like, wow, really? That's the movie you're going to tell? But yeah, so it's not great. It is. It's a little bit disappointing, but then it does do some interesting things, so I don't want to fully write it off. Mm-hmm. And it has some good ideas. It just doesn't quite get over the finish line.
That's a really nice cast for a film.
It is a super, super talented cast, and they're all really, really good. And, you know, they all have their little moments, and they, like, nail it. It's just – it's a bit underwhelming. It just doesn't quite get there, which is kind of, and then it ends and you're like, that's how you're ending this? Okay. It's underwhelming overall.
Oh, wow. So
I was disappointed. But I mean, if you're looking for a space movie that looks pretty great, you could do much worse. This one looks pretty good, and it's not bad. It's just doesn't quite nail it for me.
Okay. And that one's on Amazon Prime.
It's on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
Yep.
So my next movie is, God, how do you even introduce this one? I'm just going to say it. I was going to do a big fanfare, but no, I'm just going to say it. It's Mortal Kombat.
Oh, yeah. I should have the soundboard with the techno Mortal Kombat music.
Mortal Kombat.
I love it.
We did a group watch of it, and every time someone said the word Mortal Kombat in the movie, I just like, shouted out, Mortal Kombat.
I love it. You have to.
And then there was a training scene. I'm like, Mortal Training. Anyways, Mortal Kombat. I think everyone knows what this movie is by this point. It got released on HBO Max. It's also on premium rental. You can get it on iTunes and YouTube and wherever else. It's from director Simon McQuaid, who is mostly, or sorry, Simon McQuaid. who is a commercial director mostly, and also does like a bunch of spots for video games. So in a way, he's kind of a natural fit for this. I mean, it's a good looking movie. A lot of the people I saw it with were very disappointed by this movie. They were to the point of being upset. I think their expectations were too high, because I think there's a very definite ceiling on how good a Mortal Kombat movie can be. I'm even of the camp that, like, I don't think it's possible to make a quote-unquote good Mortal Kombat movie. And as long as you go in there with those expectations, like, I know what this thing is, it was fine.
I agree.
Dialogue is ridiculous. The characters are non-existent. But there's some fight stuff in there that's cool.
Oh, there's some there's some great special effects. The fight sequence with the ice dude in the gym, the one that's in the trailer.
Sub-Zero and Scorpion, which they save for the end, which is like the big kind of highlight. And it's pretty good. It's enjoyable.
Oh, yeah.
And it is kind of nice. The one kind of titular thing about this film that I think is nice to finally see is, like, this is the first time we've really gotten a good kind of like bloody R-rated version of Mortal Kombat
on screen. Which is kind of what you need for the video game.
Yeah, it's Mortal Kombat. And like with the 95 version, I get it. Video game movies weren't really a big thing yet. They were trying to go for a 14-year-old male audience. Now that same audience that they targeted for that movie in the 90s, they now have kids of their own, and they're still watching Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
So they can go for the R rating. And, you know, it's kind of nice to see these fights where you have, like, oh, there's a bunch of blood and, you know, people getting carved up. It's like you're not used to seeing that in movie form, but very much in the game form. So it's entertaining enough. I don't think I'll ever watch it again.
No, I thought it was fine too. Dan also didn't care for it. I think he was expecting too much. I was like, what are you talking about? That was great.
Yeah.
It was. I thought it was super enjoyable. I was all for it.
Yeah, if you lower your expectations and just go in expecting some dumb, you know, disposable fun.
Yeah.
I think you'll probably have a good time.
Some very wooden performances.
Yes.
Very wooden performance.
If you're expecting it to finally do justice to the story that is Mortal Kombat.
What story?
I know.
I was like, stop with the backstory. Just give me the kills. Yeah.
Okay, just tiny little rant on my part. This is my big problem with Mortal Kombat, is that Mortal Kombat at this point, because it's like 13 games deep at this point, it does not have characters. It has archetypes. And it does not have story. It has lore, and lore is not story, but people will oftentimes mistake it for story because it's just backstory, but it's not a story. It's not characters going on a journey and having arcs that are fulfilling in a narrative. You can't build it out of that. So a lot of people think that there's story there in Mortal Kombat, but there really isn't. And so when they make these films, when they try to make a Mortal Kombat film, you're arriving to it with half-baked archetype characters and all of this baggage backstory that the fans demand be there. Otherwise, it's not Mortal Kombat, which does not leave space for any actual story. So that's why I say that I don't think it's possible to make a quote-unquote good Mortal Kombat movie. I think this is probably about as good as it gets.
And I'm okay with that. I would watch a sequel. No problem. Give me more of the same.
And it sounds like there probably will be one.
Yeah.
I think it was pretty successful for them. Okay. And I mean, just about anything right now is going to be pretty successful because there's not a lot of competition. So
yeah, true.
Yeah.
Pretty much, which is why we all watch the same things on opening weekend, right?
Exactly. So, all right, what have you got next on yours?
So I did this. So this has been going on for a couple of years, but a few of the people that I kind of follow in my circle of movie watching friends, they do this like death race to the Oscars where they try to watch all of the movies that were nominated. You can't always get there because there's a lot of stuff that you can't even watch anywhere. Mm-hmm. But I thought I wasn't going to do it. And then a week out, I was like, you know, I'm not missing that many titles. I think I can finish this. So I did my very best. I did watch everything that was available. And there was a lot of shit in the mix. Like, there was a lot of stuff that I watched that I really didn't care for, especially in the foreign language category. And Pinocchio, I still don't get what the deal is with Pinocchio, but that's besides the point. But among all of that BS, I watched The White Tiger, which is on Netflix. So this is Ramin Bahrani's new movie. And he is best known for these like tiny little sort of indie movies. He did Man Push Cart and Goodbye Solo, which were both really, really good. And then a few years ago, he did 99 Homes, which was kind of like his step up. This is like a leap 5 years in the future. It is so good. So it's based on a book. It's set in India, and it's about this little orphan boy that basically makes good, but in a bad way. It's very Martin Scorsese, like Goodfellas, like bad guy involved in bad things, but that ultimately is somewhat successful. But it is just, it's so good. They shoot the shit out of it. It's super entertaining. I could have watched another 4 hours of it. I highly recommend it. If you watch nothing else, The White Tiger is the movie to watch.
Okay.
It's very, very, very good.
I am adding it to my list right now.
And if anybody out there that's like, oh, it's subtitles, ignore that, because most of it is in English. It's Indian, but most of it is in English. So you'll be okay. But yeah.
Also, anyone who's out there is like, subtitles. What are you even doing with your life? Just watch a good movie.
Exactly. I mean, I would say watch Another Round, which is also like superb. But this is like on an entertainment level alone, it's the kind of movie that you could get anybody to watch. Mm. Because it's like action packed, and it does have that little mafia thing going on. And it is a bit of a thriller, and it's really, really good and really smart and super entertaining. So yeah, this one came out of like left field for me. I was super impressed, and I highly recommend it. So if you haven't seen it yet, The White Tiger is high on my recommendation list. So
that's awesome. It is on my list now.
So what else you got?
So the next thing on my list that I did watch is not a small or important film. It is a big and unimportant film. I watched Godzilla vs. Kong. Also premium rental, HBO Max. So I guess I'm going to start off with my history with the MonsterVerse, so to speak, the recent kind of cinematic universe of monster movies that they've been doing. There was Godzilla in, 2015, I want to say, something like that. And then there was Godzilla King of the Monsters, which yep. came out a couple of years ago. And then the King Kong Skull Island movie, which came out. The first Godzilla movie, I really didn't like it. I thought it was boring. I do not have a giant affinity for Godzilla in general that most people seem to hold in their hearts. And despite Bryan Cranston being in it, and it, you know, trying to like say something, you know, maybe meaningful, I found it an incredibly dull film and could not get into it. And King of the Monsters for me, honestly, was even worse.
Oh, it's terrible.
Not like that movie it's at so all.
No,
it was a sleeping pill of a film, and everyone's like getting so excited about it. I was like, whatever they're seeing, I am not seeing.
Yeah, I totally missed the boat on that too.
And so I skipped the King Kong movie for a long time. And then finally I heard people say, no, it's actually genuinely good. And so I watched it on Netflix. And I was actually genuinely surprised at how much I enjoyed it. I thought the writing was much sharper. I thought it was nicely subversive. It had a great cast of characters in it. You have Samuel Jackson and Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston. Basically a freaking Marvel movie.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I didn't think of that.
In it.
Yeah.
And that's almost the fun thing you can do now. Just go back to movies and find out, oh, 80% of this cast has been in a Marvel movie now.
So yeah, which is pretty much everybody at this
point. So everything's just part of the MCU now. but no, I thought it was so much fun. And it's like, I was blown away. Maybe I'm wrong on this. And it's like, okay, I don't like the Godzilla movies, but I like the King Kong movie. And then Adam Wingard, who is a director who, I'm going to say it's hit or miss. There's some stuff he does that I really like. I like Your Next a lot.
Yep.
I really love The Guest.
Love The Guest.
Blair Witch, not so much.
Yeah.
His Death Note movie, I didn't watch it, but I heard nothing but horrible things about it.
It's not good.
Yeah. So I'm on an Adam Wingard side. I'm on the I want Wingard to win side. And he was doing Godzilla versus Kong. And, you know, doing like the you know, Avengers of MonsterVerse movies, essentially. And that's the best way to describe this movie.
Yeah.
It plays out like an Avengers movie. It's like a superhero film, except your protagonists are Godzilla and King Kong.
Yep.
And I was so skeptical. I was expecting to hate this movie just because of my previous experience with the other movies. And I was completely turned around by the end. It's a dumb movie, but it was so much fun.
It is a fun, dumb movie.
The whole way through. He knows exactly what type of movie this needs to be to be a fun movie. And he delivers it constantly. There's always new stuff coming at you. It is a visual delight. And not just on a special effects level, but just in the design of the film. It's just very colorful and very fun to watch. And it's outrageous in all the ways you want it to be outrageous. And I don't know, it was just a really good time. It's like, if this is what the Godzilla movies were, then I would have enjoyed them a lot more. I would have been able to just sort of shut off and enjoy the fun.
No, I agree. I thought this was way better than I expected. Dan did make me watch King of the Monsters because of the tie-in. Mm-hmm. So not worth your time. Oh my God. I wish I could get those 2 hours back, but I can't. So that's fine. But yeah, I thought it was fine. I really, really enjoyed it. I agree. I think it's probably, I was not a huge fan of Skull Island. Like, I thought it was fine, but I found it a little bit underwhelming. But this, I really enjoyed it. Like you say, it really is a visual treat. And I do think that for me, one of the key things is the visual effects here are like stupendous. Like there is no hiding things in the dark. Like they're to the point now where they can do like a full out, full CG action sequence in the daylight. And it just looks fucking spectacular. And they totally make great use of it. And it looks amazing. And for me, I think my favorite part is the sea battle, which just should not work, but totally does. Totally does.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I can't recommend it enough. If you have a chance to watch it, then if you're even remotely inclined to want to watch this movie, I think you're going to have fun with it.
I agree. If you have any interest whatsoever, yeah, you should probably watch this right
and
away.
Because from what I understand, this may actually be the end of it. Because from what I understand, Legendary after this no longer has the rights to Godzilla.
Oh.
So either a new agreement is going to have to happen. I think they could still make King Kong movies, but I think this is it for Godzilla unless they get some new deal going. And given how successful this film has been.
I think Toho's going to jump on the opportunity to redo that
Chris
deal.
Chris Nolan said he was going to save theaters with his movie, but that didn't happen, but Adam Wingard kind of did.
Did, yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, I think you're right. I think it would be short-sighted of them not to sign another deal.
Everybody likes money.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
So I have an oldie but a goodie. This has been a really big blind spot for a long time, and I've been meaning to watch this forever, and I've just never really found the time. And then the other day, Manhunter was on, I don't know, some channel that we get. And it's like, it was halfway through the movie. I'm like, oh, I think I can watch this from the beginning. So I finally watched Michael Mann's Manhunter. And fuck, this movie is good. It's so good. And I can see why it's a bit of a classic. I think for me, the thing I appreciate the most about this, and I mean, Michael Mann is kind of a genius anyways, but the fact that this movie isn't dark and like, it doesn't feel like a serial killer horror movie that you would watch now. Like mm-hmm. it's very 80s. It's shiny and glossy, and Dolarhyde lives in this like gorgeous white and beige house, and everything is beautiful. And then there's all these like ugly things underneath. It totally works. And it holds up super, super well for a movie that's now, you know, 20 some odd years old, maybe almost 30. Superb. It's awesome. And I highly, highly, highly recommend it. And I was really surprised by this cast. Like, I really like William Peterson as Will Graham. And Cox is great as Lecter. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very small bit part in comparison to what Lecter became later. But, man, it's solid. I was really, really impressed. And I'm like, oh, hey.
Yeah.
This is good.
This movie is very much not a blind spot for me. I've seen this movie many times. I love Manhunter, as I love most of Michael Mann's movies. But for anyone who doesn't know, this is basically the prequel to Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
And instead of Clarice Starling, your protagonist is Will Graham, who most people have probably seen the version of Will Graham that was in the Hannibal TV series mm-hmm. that was on a while ago, which is, you know, very similar. They were going through the whole Red Dragon storyline as well. But I really prefer this version. I think William Peterson does a really good job in the role of showing a character who's basically, he's a profiler, and he gets in so deep into the headspace of the people that he's chasing that it actually mentally hurts him.
Yeah.
It takes over his life and kind of corrupts him in a way that makes him a potentially dangerous person. You see this play out in the film where it's like his own family to a degree. It's like, they're in recovery from the last time that he did this.
Yeah.
And they're all dealing with like that trauma that he is internally trying to like keep out of their lives and just like solve on his own. And he gets pulled back into it. And you can see like the strain that it puts on him, that puts on his family. And that component of it always made it, on a protagonist level, more interesting to me than Silence of the Lambs. I love Silence of the Lambs a lot. I think it's a near perfect movie.
Yeah.
But I like the protagonist of Will Graham more. And I agree. I think Brian Cox, who is just an incredible actor, who I guarantee, even if you don't recognize his name, you recognize
You've
the
seen
man
him.
Because he has been in a billion things and you know his voice. And here where he's much younger and is playing Hannibal Lecter, you know, as iconic as Anthony Hopkins made that role, Brian Cox absolutely nails it. And there is like an alternate reality where he's the one who carries forward the Hannibal Lecter role through the films. And we would not be poorer for it.
No, agreed.
He does a great job here. Taking away nothing from what Anthony Hopkins does, because he's brilliant as well. But I don't think he can be undersold just how great he is in this movie. And Tom Noonan as the Tooth Fairy, the serial killer that he's chasing, which he just plays as this wonderfully kind of like detached but also tortured soul. It's a fascinating film, and it's a really fun police procedural. And yes, having been made in like 1986, produced by Dino De Laurentiis, it is very much a 80s film.
Yeah, it's very much of its time.
All the ways that Michael Mann makes an 80s film.
Yes.
It has that thief sheen to it.
Yeah.
You know, It's not Miami Vice cool, because he is making something that's a lot darker, but he's definitely bringing that same sort of like produced sensibility to this film.
Yeah.
But if you haven't seen it, definitely go back and check this one out, because it is still a fantastic film that holds up great.
Yeah, agreed. I'm glad
it was ahead of its time.
For sure. I'm glad to have finally caught up with it. That's for sure.
Yeah. I'm glad you saw it too.
I feel enriched.
And I'm also glad that I saw, how do you like that segue? I'm also glad that I saw, I checked out the movie Nobody. Which is a premium rental. And it's also in theaters right now if you, you know, are vaccinated and can get to theaters. But this is a movie that is directed by, I'm going to totally butcher this name, but Ilya Neuschiller, who is the director of Hardcore Henry, Russian director.
Yep.
Hardcore Henry, a movie which I was not a huge fan of. It's like, I get the gimmick is neat for 10 minutes.
This is why
80 more minutes of movie.
This is it. I mean, the gimmick was great for short films. I didn't think it was quite as good for the feature, but you know what?
There's some impressive stuff in there, but it's like, it's not a movie I'm ever going to watch again.
No.
But it's also, probably more importantly, Nobody is written by Derek Kolstad, who, of course, is responsible for the John Wick franchise. And here, it's like, you'd almost want to say that Nobody is basically just like John Wick Light, or John Wick spinoff, practically. It's like, Derek Kolstad has one story, and he's just going to keep telling that story over and over.
That's totally fine. As long as they keep casting the movies properly, it totally works.
So in this case, Bob Odenkirk is just like, you know, the middle-aged loser with a family in the suburbs and a dead-end job, and he's not really like, you know, he's got the burbs doldrums, basically. And then one night, some people break into his home to do a home invasion, and he just lets them go. But it kind of like starts him on this path of trying to reclaim something in his life. And that's when we discover that he's got this whole past that he's even kept hidden from his family, where he was essentially John Wick in another life. That's like the long and short of it. And he basically comes out of the gate and starts going looking for trouble and ends up in pretty much the exact same story as John Wick, where he gets, you know, he ends up beating up the wrong kid who's the family member of a Russian mobster. And now the Russian mobster wants him dead, and the Russian mobsters come to his home and shoot it up, and he fights them off and kills everyone. And, you know, if you've seen John Wick, you've seen the story before. The difference is that, well, A, it's Bob Odenkirk. And while I wouldn't call this movie a comedy, I've heard some people describe it as a comedy or even a dark comedy. I don't even think it's that much of a comedy. It has moments of levity in it, like any film, but Bob Odenkirk's playing it straight. And he's playing it surprisingly well, too. He is kind of believable in this. And one of the things that I think makes it most interesting is, unlike John Wick, he's not walking into a room and completely owning it like a total badass. It's like the first fight he gets into, he takes some pretty hard licks himself.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he takes out everyone on the bus, but he also gets his ass beat 6 ways from Sunday in the process.
Yeah.
As just like a small action film where you kind of know what to expect from it, and maybe a little bit of what you're not expecting just based on the fact that Bob Odenkirk, it's actually a really fun movie. I'd highly recommend it, except the only thing I didn't like about it is ultimately the story is telling you, it's like, well, to become a real man again, he's got to embrace violence and start kicking the shit out of a bunch of people. Before that, he's just emasculated. His wife won't even sleep with him. And after he comes home all bruised and bloody and knuckles bleeding, all of a sudden his wife finds him attractive again. And it's like, there's some kind of like really toxic ideas of masculinity in this film that in 2021 are not all that comfortable. And I think we could move past this shit by now. But other than that, I found the film incredibly fun.
Yeah, no, I'm with you 110%. You absolutely nailed it. Exactly my thoughts. we really enjoyed it as well, but I had some serious issues with the relationship story for sure. But overall it was fun. And bus sequence is like legit spectacular.
Yes.
The choreography on that is kind of, it's tops, tops.
It may not be worth the price of a premium rental right now, like, you know, $25 to see this movie. Probably not. I did, but, you know, maybe wait for it to either come down in price to a more rentable price or a more sell-through price or show up on some streaming network. But it definitely is worth a watch.
Agreed. Smaller, much smaller Canadian project. Canada has a thing for werewolves. I don't know what it is. We tend to make decent werewolf movies. Just saying.
Must be all the trees.
It's probably all the trees. So Amelia Moses's Bloodthirsty, which stars Lauren Beatty and Greg Burke. Lauren Beatty plays a musician who travels to some like out of the way home of this iconic producer who may or may not have killed his last person that he worked with. I don't know. It's a weird setup. But basically she's like, she's vegan and she's very, she's a lesbian. And so she goes to this house to record this new album because she's having trouble. And she starts having dreams, maybe dreams about like eating, not just eating meat, but killing animals and eating them. There's this whole story. I don't know. It's okay. I wish I had better things to say. I thought it was a little bit overwrought. Greg Burke is always really good, and he's really good here. The story just kind of like doesn't quite get there. The music, because she's a musician, the whole thing sort of revolves around the music and the writing. Like the idea is that she's stuck and she goes to this producer to kind of unstick herself and sort of create the next great album. And the music is really good. So Lowell is a Canadian artist, super talented, and the music is legit good in the movie. The movie is just kind of like not quite there. The whole werewolf thing doesn't fully develop the way you might want it to. And it has this really weird, like, backstory that is totally unnecessary and just feels like a way to like infuse some, I don't know, emotion into it. The whole thing just kind of feels like it just doesn't quite work. I wish it was better. Doesn't fully work for me.
Ah, that's disappointing.
Yeah.
So fun fact, I have not seen this movie, but I do know Amelia. And I actually edited a film that she directed like ages ago for a 48-hour horror competition.
Oh, wow.
Where we did one of those. It was like right out of film school. Like, God, like over like 12 years ago.
Oh, wow.
When she was in Vancouver. And it was like one of the first things I edited after I got out of film school. And one of the first things she ever directed. And we did one of those 48-hour films for Bloodshots, which was a now-defunct Vancouver 48-hour horror film festival.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't realize there was a local... That's awesome.
Yeah. And I ran into her in Montreal when I was out there for Fantasia a few years ago. And, you know, we've sort of kept in touch, but I have... She's been doing quite well for herself. She's got, like, a couple features under her belt now. So it's...
And I mean, you know, to like all things
come a long way.
Oh yeah, and I mean, all things considered, like the story is the thing that kind of doesn't quite get there for this one. But I mean, it looks amazing, and it is really well acted and really well directed. Like Lauren Beatty is super talented, and like I'm biased. I really like Greg, but overall, for me, it was the story that just didn't really work for me. But it does have some pretty intense and gory scenes. It really does go for the gusto, which I really appreciated. So it is certainly bloody. There's some moments.
That's
awesome. I just wish I liked it more. What else did you got?
So less genre side, I watched a documentary
Ooh.
Called AKA Jane Roe.
Oh, yeah.
Which is on Hulu. Which this is, as you might guess, this is a documentary all about the woman who is the Jane Roe, which is, like, that's not her actual name. Her real name is Norma McCorvey. But she was given the name Jane Roe for the case that they fought in Texas to try to overturn abortion in that state. And then, of course, got taken up to the Supreme Court and became the landmark legal case that made it legal for women to get abortion all across the U.S. And she's become a very interesting figure in the abortion fight over the years because, and the documentary follows that. It follows basically like her history, who she was, where she sort of came from when she entered this fight. And she was basically picked up by attorneys who were looking to fight that fight. And she fit a very particular bill of the person they want to have be the face of that fight that would make it give them the best chance to overturn the law. And she also reached this point where after it became the law of the land that abortion become legal, shortly thereafter, she basically converted to Christianity, became born again, and started becoming an activist against abortion rights. And it was very perplexing on multiple levels, but she was also like a poor, uneducated woman who was working cleaning houses. And when it came out that she was Jane Roe, her life was under attack. She would come home and like her house would be shot up. And, you know, it was like all kinds of horrific. And the kind of bombshell that this documentary has, like it does a really good job of just kind of walking you through, okay, from like the 70s on forward, here was the kind of cultural state of abortion in the United States and the huge battle that basically took place with the religious right trying to overturn it and still trying to overturn it. And all this peppered with real life interviews of Norma before she died. The documentary was basically something that she wanted to do so that she could be on the record before she passed. And it's like, it's her deathbed confession, essentially. And she even says as such. And the bombshell, which I'm just going to outright spoil it because it's out there anyways, but it's still definitely worth watching, is she reveals that like her entire time of campaigning against abortion rights, she was paid. The organization, Operation Rescue, which was the anti-abortion Christian coalition group, basically came to her and said, here's what we want you to say and here's money. And they just kept paying her and she kept going in front of the camera and speaking and people weren't shooting at her and she was earning an income. And part of me can't blame her given the situation that she was in. But it's also feels like a little bit of like a betrayal where this woman who helped create one of the most landmark decisions to give women reproductive rights in the United States then had no problem just kind of turning around and working against it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very complicated. Norma's very complicated as well. She's a hard woman to kind of put your finger on. And the documentary really kind of gets into that. And it's very, very interesting. There's lots of like different documentaries that are out there about the abortion issue, but this one approaches it with, you know, a very unique perspective, really unique look at this woman who was responsible for, you know, this important ruling and everything that went on behind with the manipulation of a Christian organization willing to just outright buy this woman off to try to get it overturned.
Yeah.
And how unscrupulous basically the Christian right is in this regard.
The sad part about this is I think people that actually do need to watch the documentary and know the story probably won't.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Sadly. Oh, it's really good to hear that that's good. I had heard about it and it had completely fallen off my radar. So I'll definitely have to add that to my watch list. That's great to hear that it's good. Okay, so Snowpiercer season 2. Let's get into this. So I did not really care for season 1 of Snowpiercer. I kind of watched it out of almost like necessity. Like I felt like I needed to watch it because I really like the movie and I really do like the comic books. It's like it's basically the few, I haven't read a lot of comic books in my life, but that's one that those are two that I did read. So I kind of felt like I needed to see where the story was going. Season 2 does not start off the best, but by like, I think the middle of episode 2, I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I ended up, unbeknownst to me, I mainlined the rest of the season. Jesus Christ, this show gets really good so fast. Like it just, you don't even notice that you're getting like totally invested. And then by the time you realize that the season is over, goes places you don't really expect. Really, really, really solid. Like really, and so twisted in a way that I really did not expect. Sometimes some of the scenes you kind of don't even really think about what's happening. And then you think about it afterwards and you're like, Jesus, that was really dark. Like super, super dark. It's good. It's really good. Really, really good. I can't really say enough good things about the show.
That's excellent.
Season 2 is so much like superior to season 1. It's like not even, it almost doesn't even feel like the same show.
So I haven't seen any of the TV show. I've seen the movie, like the movie a lot, but I just, for whatever reason, I have not checked into the show yet. Would you say it's worthwhile to jump in?
Oh, yes. For sure. I mean, I think that you do kind of need to watch a little. I think you do need to watch season 1 because it does do an interesting, like it's not obvious until you get to kind of to the end of season 1 and then you jump into season 2 because they do set up a universe before season 2 starts. And then when season 2 is kind of like they kind of flip that reality on its head. So at the beginning, at the end of season 1, they actually meet a second train and then the entire thing gets turned upside down because now the second train kind of has all the power, but it really doesn't. But you have to kind of know the dynamics of the characters and the universe that prevailed before and how it's become now. So there is, I think you do really need to watch season 1, though it's not as good as season 2, but season 2 is like, yeah, it's like they really lean into the darkness in a way that was completely unexpected. I mean, it's going to be dark and gritty anyways. You have the last remnants of the universe of like living in this car, in this train, and there is a lot of economic disparity, and it's just like the movie. It's really dark and dirty and ugly, but season 2 gets into more of like the psychological impact of that, and it really leans into it in ways that are shocking in a very dark, dark way.
I'll have to add that to my list.
And Game of Thrones fans will be disappointed by Ned Stark's actions. I will say this now. I warn you people, he is not all good. But yeah, it's great. I was very pleasantly impressed by season 2.
Okay. I will definitely give that a shot.
What you got? What else you got?
All right. So I'm not going to spend too long on this one, but I watched Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Ah, yes.
Disney.
Okay, I'm curious.
The new Marvel series.
Yeah, I'm curious if you're a fan or not a fan.
Of the series in general?
Yeah.
I thought it was good. I liked it a lot.
Okay, good. We can keep talking then. Yeah. No, I'm kidding.
I don't think I loved it as much as WandaVision. I think it's probably it's less consistent, I think. I think this one was a little bit I don't want to say all over the map, but there's like some stuff that worked better than other stuff, some story elements that I think felt a little bit more half-baked than they should have been. From what I hear, there was supposed to be a virus component to the story, that like the Flag Smashers released like a virus or something along those lines that ended up getting cut from the story. And I think that's part of the reason why the Flag Smashers themselves don't feel nearly as like fully realized as they should be in the show. But I still like the show a lot. Anthony Mackie and Sebastian Stan are great together. You really get a nice kind of Lethal Weapon vibe.
Yeah. In
a lot of the show, with the interaction that these two guys have with each other, where it's like they're at each other's throats most of the time, you know, but they're going to get to like a begrudging respect for each other sort of thing. And they just have a great dynamic together. I thought the development of both their characters was really great, especially for Anthony Mackie and probably even more for this series, but for what it's going to mean for the MCU at large, because, you know, spoiler alert, it basically ends with just saying outright, he is Captain America. You're no longer going to be calling him Falcon. He's just Captain America now.
Yeah.
You know, get used to it. He's here. And there's some moments in the film or in the series, which are genuinely heartfelt and resonant and very impactful. Especially, I thought the last episode landed a lot of emotional beats very effectively, and I liked it a lot, even if I don't think it necessarily felt like it earned those emotional beats. Like, I don't think it had done enough groundwork to get to those emotional beats. I still enjoyed them in the finale and thought were really solid. And of course, Wyatt Russell as the, I guess, U.S. agent, the fake Captain America, who comes with, I don't know, there's just like so much subtext that he arrives into the show with, where he's basically a false idol, but he's also being representative of kind of a police authority and what that means to people like Sam. It's like, here's how he treats black men, you know, it, as an authority figure. That's baked into it very largely as well. And it's a solid show, I never was disappointed by any of it, but there were times at which I wasn't blown away by it all the time.
Yeah, for me, I think this is probably my favorite of the batch of Marvel shows. And maybe I think I even enjoy this more than some of the Marvel movies, because it feels more adult than the rest of them. It tackles some concepts and ideas in a very real and tangible way that I thought was really effective. And it's really dark and kind of brutal. I think this is maybe one of the first of the Marvel Universe shows, movies that like gets into like the real like blood of it all. Like that scene with the fake Captain America losing his shit. Mm-hmm. Like that was intense, and I did not see that coming. Yeah. And I kind of appreciate that Kerry Scoglund is like fucking killing it. Good for her.
The Brian Salisbury over at Junk Food Cinema, he put out a tweet that I thought like really encapsulated it the best. This is one of the best descriptions of it, where it basically Steve Rogers is how America views itself, and what's his name? Walker is how America really is.
Yeah. That's so, so on the nose. It's perfect. That's really perfect. And yeah. I think that's probably one of the reasons I really like the show, because it does feel like it's tackling some big issues in a way that I appreciate more than some of the other movies that have come before it. But overall, I think you're right. I think that it doesn't quite get all of the emotional beats that it tries for. But overall, I thought it was a really solid attempt, and I really did enjoy it. I thought it was... I was actually really like looking forward to watching on a week to week basis. And I'm kind of disappointed that it was such a short season, but I think that they did quite a lot. I do have one major criticism: not enough Daniel Brühl dancing. Like, you had that opening and you give it like 2 seconds, and I could have watched that for like 10 minutes.
I love how quickly they jumped on that meme. It's like people started like losing their shit over it on Twitter.
Yes.
And then immediately they're just like, here's a 1 hour video of him dancing that they cobbled together out of all of the footage they could find.
It's all the Daniel Brühl fans out there, man. We're a bad bunch, man.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. No, I totally agree. And like, now that the season is kind of done, I sort of felt this way with WandaVision as well. Because I did go back and rewatch that show, being able to watch it as a batch. And as much as I do love the week to week, because I it's nice to have a show. It's like, oh, here's something I'm excited to look forward to every week to watch this show. As much as I enjoyed in that sense, I think there is a kind of like cohesiveness, because it is telling one cohesive story that is being... that I think I lose a little bit from watching it week to week.
Mm.
And so now that the whole thing is finished, I'm kind of looking forward to getting a chance to. And it's like, they're bite-sized episodes for the most part. It's like 30, 40 minutes per episode. So it makes it really easy. It's just like, and there's not that many episodes. There's what, 8?
Yeah.
Just go back and watch the entire series as bulk again, you know, like watch it over the course of 2 evenings or whatnot. And I have a feeling it will probably like feel a bit more cohesive for me than it's feeling right now.
Yeah.
Because where it was in episode one feels like so far away by comparison.
You know? Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
The last thing that, it's not the last thing that I watched, but the only other thing that I wanted to talk about that we watched, kind of because there's been a bit of a rut on the TV side of things, but we finally watched Q Into the Storm, which is the QAnon documentary on HBO, which is not really a QAnon documentary. It's like a history of 8chan, 4chan, all of the chans. I don't even know. This thing is such a clusterfuck of a show. Like, it starts as one thing, and the next thing you know, it's like this bizarre thriller, or you're trying to escape the Philippines before going to... Okay, it's nuts. Yeah, I'm not really sure how I feel about it. We finished it the other day, and I'm like, this doesn't feel so much as an exploration of who Q is, but just like this weird deep dive into this crazy little sub corner of the internet that's like where all the evil and vile things of the universe live. And yeah, what a cast of characters, man.
Yeah,
you can't make that shit up.
So I've been following the whole QAnon thing for quite a while, because it's just something that I'm like both fascinated by and terrified by. There was another documentary I saw recently that basically put in an estimation that something like about 10% of Americans at this point believe in QAnon, which
shocking.
puts it like, what, I think 30 billion people in the country. And that's not something that just goes away. That's a systemic problem at that point.
You might as well...
People like, become conspiratorial.
Yeah.
It's become a new form of religion.
Yeah.
And also for such an absurd conspiracy that doesn't even hold up to the slightest scrutiny, yet people are willing to go invade and take over with violent force government buildings because of it and die for it. And it is alarming on so many levels. And so as a result, I've been keeping track on it for probably about, you know, a little over a year. You know, I've known about it ever since it's like been out there, but I'm definitely read up on the subject more than the average bear. And you're right. This documentary does not do a really good job of explaining what the QAnonymous conspiracy is, but that's also not what it's trying to do.
No.
There are other documentaries out there that do that. HBO even had another one that was earlier in the year. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was Q something. But they did like a 3-part documentary that kind of did a lot better job of just covering, here's the shoe leather of what this conspiracy is. We're going to talk to people who believe in it, sort of thing. And part of the trend over the last year, maybe a little less than that, like other podcasts have done this as well, is trying to track down, okay, can we figure out who Q actually is? And this is the one documentary that this is as close to a smoking gun as you're going to get that lays it at the feet. It's the son of the guy who owns 8chan. That's who Q is. And he kind of drops his guard enough and lets it on in a way without actually fully confessing that it's like, yeah, he's the guy who's freaking doing it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a bombshell. This documentary gets into places that no one else has ever gotten into. So yeah. If this is a subject that you're even remotely interested in, this documentary has bombshell information within it.
Oh, yeah. And I think one of the reasons that it manages to get the detail that it gets and the video that it gets and the access to the people that he gets access to is the fact that he's been at this for what seems like, you know, at least 6 years, because he has footage from before the election, throughout the presidency, and into post-election. So clearly he's been doing this research for a long, long time. And those relationships really pay off for him. Like, he really does get access to some of the key players. I think what I'm always kind of skeptical about movies and shows like this that kind of like lean into the absurdity and like just the unbelievableness of it all is like, what are you leaving out to make it this like to tick along like this? Cause it does really feel like almost like a scripted documentary because it does like, it nails those moments so well. I do kind of look at it and go, oh, well, what are you not showing me? But as, purely entertaining with some fascinating content and some interesting ideas. And like, I don't follow the QAnon thing. So like, a lot of these people are people that I don't recognize. I don't really know anything about them, but I thought it was an interesting introduction into that world that I didn't realize was kind of as like, clearly it's large because a lot of people do believe in it, but I didn't realize it was that organized. I think that's the thing that surprised me the most. Yeah. And it's just, it actually is super, super entertaining in this really bizarre, bizarre way. Mm. And it really gets into things that I'm like, I did not expect. Like, I really didn't think I was going to get a history of 4chan and a history of 8chan and meet the crazy psychos that run this thing. Like,
yeah,
the whole thing is just kind of this mind-blowing mess of a show. Super engaging and entertaining.
Unfortunately for me, this crazy cast of characters like Jim Watkins and his son
Psycho
and Frederick Brennan are not kind of new to me in a sense, because these were all people who were key components and players during the entire Gamergate thing. During a period which I would happen to get doxxed and swatted because of Gamergate. So I am very aware of who these people are and the problem that they were posing. And I have very complicated feelings about Frederick Brennan, the guy who created 8chan, and now since kind of like, he's tried to do a 180, and he's been trying to get like, make sure that 8chan gets taken down, and he's sort of repentant for what he created and the havoc it's caused, because his site, which he protected and defended for a long time, caused a lot of damage in a lot of people's lives, my own included. So it's really hard for me to go, yeah, Frederick Brandon is someone who I should have sympathy for. It's really difficult. At the same time, it's like, yes, Ron and Jim Watkins, these guys are fucking psychopaths.
Yeah.
And everything that you see in this documentary is everything that I already knew about these people. So none of the characters in this documentary are surprised me at all. It's just the new information that gets revealed as a result of it.
Yeah.
So I thought it was fascinating and maybe a little bit cathartic too.
Yeah. And for somebody on the outside that doesn't know anything about it, I thought it was very informative in a super entertaining and really creepy way.
Yeah. It's definitely one of the weirdest stories of our time. Yeah. All right. Last thing I've got on my list is I wanted to come back to this show because I finally finished it, which is the show 30 Coins on HBO Max or Crave if you're in Canada, which is the Spanish religious horror series from Alex de Iglesias. And damn, this show is so good. I love this show. And by the time you get to the last episode, you start the first episode, you're like, oh shit, they're coming out of the gate swinging. This is wild and intense. I wonder if the show is going to calm down after this, go to episode two. Nope, not calming down at all. And then by the time you get to the last episode, it's like, okay, it's like we're just going to like sort of like wrap up the threads and, you know, sort of like thread the needle on this one. No, we're going to have a giant demon just burst out of the ground and the priest coming at him with Uzis. It's like, yes, it is that type of show. And it is exactly the show that I am here for. It is like, if anything I described is your jam, then you're going to love the hell out of the show. It is so good. I enjoyed it so much.
I'm so excited. I just
hope to God that they get to do more seasons. Apparently, he's got a 3-season arc that he wants to do for the show, even though it hasn't been announced whether or not season 2 is going to happen. But the show has a pretty dedicated fan base already, so hopefully.
I'm excited for you to watch the rest of his stuff because he's he's so weird.
I've got like 8 of his other films that are on my list. I picked up I picked up Day of the Beast and one of the other ones, the one with Rosie Perez and Javier Bardem.
Oh yeah, I would start with that.
Yeah. The very shortly after I got into the show, I was like, holy crap, this show is so good. And immediately other people are like, you need to check out the director's other films. And it's like, I started looking at his list of films and he has so many and I haven't seen any of them. And I was like, oh my God, how long has this man been hiding from me? It's ridiculous. And so all of these people came out, like Drew McWeeny came out and like gave me a list. Here's the films you need to watch. You know, his top on his list was 800 Bullets. So I need whole bunch that I need to watch. I've got like about 10 of them that, you know, are on my list right now. And then, you know, I wake up the next morning and it's like, wait a minute, why is this tweet getting so many likes? And I see, oh, Alex de Iglesias himself retweeted it. That's why.
So, I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but definitely, I love the heck out of this show. I sincerely hope they get to make more because it was so much fun. And yes, I'm definitely going to check out his other films because I dig his style.
Nice. I love it. I will get to the show eventually. I'm currently in the middle of something else, which I'll talk about the next time we get together.
Okay.
But right now, I'm only like halfway in, so I'm still undecided how I feel about it, but I have feelings.
That's your cliffhanger for the episode.
My cliffhanger for next time.
Other things are being watched and will be talked about.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Until then, come on by etcpod.ca. We'll link to all the things we talked about today, including the stories that we started off at the top. And watch some of this stuff. 30 Coins is on my watch list for next, as soon as I finish all the other shit that I'm watching. So Ash, where can people find you?
The easiest place to find me, if you want to come chat, say hi, or just yell at random women on the internet for having opinions, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Ashley Lynch.
And for me, you can probably find me on Twitter too. I'm not really anywhere, to be totally honest. I jump in and out of things all the time, but the best place to find me is probably on Twitter at The Marina. Just don't yell at me. I'll just ignore you. I don't engage very much.
So. If you yell at Marina, I'll come yell at you.
I love it. I have backup. I love it. We'll post links to all the things we talked about in the show notes. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with more discussions. So until then, find us on the internet. Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.